This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Well, it's just been only a few weeks since we all went to the polls on Tuesday, early part of this month for the municipal elections, at least around here in Northwest Indiana, some interesting races. As it turns out, a lot of interesting things have happened all across the Hoosier State, from election night returns coming back in, and for finding out all of this and get a better view about how not only the region, but also, for that matter, the rest of the state did on the elections front. Let's turn now to Andy Downs. He's executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne, and he's joining us from some event that he's going to, I guess, in the Fort Wayne area. And thank you for taking time to be with us on Regionally Speaking today. Nice to have you with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having us. We actually have here today retired Chief Justice Randy Shepard and former Attorney General Greg Zeller talking about the Indiana Civic Health Index. I believe they were up your way very recently having the same conversation.
Yeah, so. They were. I think they're making a tour of the state, I understand. That's very interesting.
And I do encourage people to go to in.bf.org, as in IndianaBarFoundation.org, and to check out the 2019 Indiana Civic Health Index.
That's great. And duly noted. And thank you for letting us know about that. Fill us in, if you will, give us the overall view first about how you think that the Indiana municipal elections went, because I know there were some things that were expected to happen and some things that were very much unexpected happening.
Yeah, I think this can best be summed up by the fact that both political parties, major political parties, declared victory that night and the next day, and they both had good reason to do that. The Republicans picked up a number of seats. They actually hold more municipal mayor offices than the Democrats do, and that is certainly reason for them to say they had a good day. And the Democrats can say, yes, but we control some pretty big cities, and we won them by very wide margins, and we picked up seats in Hamilton County. So each side gets to say that. Either we win because we have more seats, or we win because we won in places we weren't expected to win. I think that's maybe the best way to describe it. The interesting stuff, might be the margins of victory in Indianapolis and Fort Wayne for the Democratic candidates. Beyond that, though, I think it's interesting to look at some smaller races. A place like Bluffton, Indiana, which had been under Democratic control for a while, flipped over to Republican control. A state chair told me many, many years ago that a certain number of seats are going to flip every municipal election, and as far as he was concerned, it was hard to ever figure out the logic. He just knew that some would flip. But it's something that we do from time to time. We toss out those in office and bring in a new group of people.
I guess it's because maybe nobody can really predict for sure, I suppose, because things can change since they tend to be on the local basis, kind of based on sometimes local events or things that happen maybe statewide that might have some kind of unusual event, the impact on events, rather. We know, of course, here in Northwest Indiana, we watch very closely what happens, and we see the trends basically in many of the counties stay with Democrats. And some Republicans take seats. Some Republicans always hold seats, and you may see some Democrats that may take office, to be sure. So I suppose it's probably just maybe a case where it comes back, as we've talked before, about that phrase that all politics is local. And I guess in this case, it really does show that sometimes the surprises can happen locally.
I think you're right. And one of the things that we always have to keep in mind is that so many of the municipalities in the state of Indiana are pretty small. So when you take the fact that we're dealing with local issues, filling potholes and police protection, those sorts of things, and add to that the fact that candidates, whether they have money or not, can literally go out and meet almost every voter, you see the opportunity for party affiliation to matter a lot less. And I think that's the reality. I think that's part of the reason we see these seats shift back and forth occasionally. But as the Republicans would point out rightly, a bit of a predominance for them throughout the state, and that may be, and this is something that we'll have to do additional research on, that may be an indicator of a more significant urban-rural divide in terms of urban areas being won by Democrats, rural areas being won by Republicans. There may be a little more identifiable divide that we can find now. We'll have to wait and see.
Okay. Well, let's talk about first the urban situation here. Bring us up to date here and your thoughts about not only in your city there, Fort Wayne, but also in Indianapolis. You kind of mentioned that we've noticed before. There's some changes and then turn some incumbents getting office or staying in office at least.
Yeah, the Republicans actually managed to flip 19 offices from D to R, and that's mm-hmm. that's a fairly substantial number in spite of the hundreds of municipalities throughout the state. That's a pretty significant shift, and it gives them a majority of the seats. When we start looking, though, at the larger places, Indianapolis, I think a lot of people would agree that Jim Merritt's campaign just had trouble getting started. It never got traction, and Hogsett was running from the word go. That might explain that. Up my way, though, you had in Tim Smith, the Republican challenger, somebody who appeared to be a very, very good candidate, but may have actually not helped himself because he was running a campaign that basically said things could be better, or actually in some instances things are bad. But he had a mixed message because he would say things like, I like what's happening downtown, but, and it's hard to get people to buy into a negative message when you're not fully behind it. And then you can take a place like Muncie where, Muncie is Delaware County, and Muncie are an interesting place. But the administration of the sitting mayor, Tyler, he's not seeking re-election, and there are some problems going on in the administration, and the Republicans have managed to take control there, possibly as a way for the voters there to say we need to clean house a little bit or be a bit more transparent in what's happening here.
Well, you talk about, the possibility of mixed messages, and that does, as you say, it matters a lot more, I guess, with local races because the impact affects people a lot closer to home, literally, I suppose you could say. Do you think that maybe the changeover, and we've gone from the switch from many cities from D to R, is a case of pretty much only to local issues and not even because of state politics?
I think that a lot of them we'd be able to say, yeah, that's definitely a local issue, or perhaps bucking a trend or converting back to the norm, so to speak. And I'll go to Bluffton again, which for those who don't know, it's a city a little bit south of Fort Wayne. Ted Ellis had been the mayor there for many terms. He was a Democrat. Wells County is very much a Republican county, yet Democrats managed to hold on to Bluffton for a number of years. He chose to not seek re-election, and now the council and the mayor's office has gone Republican. So it's in some respects, it's going to what you would expect within that county from a party affiliation. And that was not that people were saying the issues were wrong that Mayor Ellis and the Democrats were focusing on, simply that with an opportunity for a clean slate, so to speak, they went with their normal approach to things. They went to the Republican Party. That doesn't mean a Democrat couldn't win there if the right issues come up and the campaign's a good one. I think that that's, in some respects, a microcosm of what we see when it's not a highly local issue, but instead a sort of a norming of the party affiliation trend within that community.
We're talking with Andy Downs, who is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics in Fort Wayne, about the 2019 municipal elections that have just ended and how the races turned out. We've had a number of, I guess, first-term mayors get to go into their second term. Is it a lot more than usual, and are there any surprises in any of these, how these results came out?
Yeah, actually, I haven't counted the first-term mayors who got reelected, so I can't say whether that's the norm or not.
Yeah.
It is, though, we have to keep in mind, in Indiana, the reelection rate is really, really high, and this gets to your issue, the point you made earlier about local issues driving things. Even if you don't happen to be the dominant political party, if people believe you're doing well, they may not even run anyone against you. I think we've all seen examples of that, where in the fall, it's an uncontested race or nominally contested race because people are generally happy with how things are going. And when you get to a smaller city, it can be hard to recruit somebody to run against someone they know who they think is doing a good job, even if you try to make the argument, well, you know, my party, our party needs to take that seat back. Well, but so-and-so, who's not my party, is my friend, and she's running the city pretty well. Why do I want to throw her out of office?
No.
It's an interesting challenge for the political party.
I guess in particular one comes to mind because we had a chance to talk with him in some time back because he was in charge at the least for this year that's passed with the statewide cities and towns organization. Dave Snow, who is the mayor of the city of Richmond, over in eastern Indiana, got reelected, and I know that, and I know him personally and experience from him. I know it was quite a challenge for him to get involved in politics. He was a newcomer, but he obviously was doing the same thing. He was doing the right things, apparently. And even with a challenge from a Republican, he was a Democrat that managed to stay in office. So.
Yeah, you know, I've spoken with hundreds of candidates over the years, and the vast majority of them run because they believe they have something to offer their community, not because they are ardently one party or another, or, you know, strictly conservative or liberal. That's not what drives them. They believe they can make a difference, and in those local races, that can come across. So you can have someone like the mayor of Richmond who's able to buck the party trend and be recognized for doing a good job.
Mm-hmm. I also asked you when we got things set up here to talk today about finding out the latest on the outcome of how some of these school districts around the state that had a referenda on their municipal ballots turned out. What did you find out, and what are your thoughts about those?
Yeah, I think if we go back to when this became the new norm, so you know, a number of years ago now, a whole lot of those referenda were actually defeated in part because the school corporations did not take them seriously as campaigns. They simply thought, well, we're doing this for the good of the kids. Certainly people will recognize that, and we'll be able to win this election easily, and they did not. So they began taking them very, very seriously as campaigns. We found, I think, a new part of the trend, which is that those who are opposed to the referenda now, they are taking them more seriously as campaigns. In fact, the district escapes me right now, but there was a district that actually hired someone to coordinate the no campaign and were successful. So I think we can expect to see some of that as we move forward. They're going to now understand that these are real campaigns. Now, I would argue that part of the upside of the schools treating these as real campaigns is that they take them seriously in terms of knowing what they want to do with the money and actually making a case to the voters that it's something that has to happen, whether that's money for capital projects, new buildings, et cetera, or money to help support teachers. They understand that they've got to make a really good case. And so it's not sort of the negative bickering that we sometimes see in maybe a state house or a mayor's office. It is really focused on that issue of the schools, and I think that allows us to get away from some of the negativity, but certainly we deserve a robust conversation when we see this. And as the two sides start taking the competition more seriously, the elections more seriously, I think we get into a more robust discussion.
Well, I know I can take this up in more detail with your Purdue University West Lafayette campus colleague, Larry DeBoer. He's the expert on all of this, and he's the fellow that probably knows more about school referenda probably than anybody else, I would imagine. So I know he gets real wonkish about this. I have to be careful sometimes.
But, he really does. We like to say he's a rock star when it comes to these things. It's a small group that see him as a rock star, but he's a rock star when we start talking about these things.
Well, Andy, thank you for spending time with us today to talk about how the municipal elections turned out. And it's been for the good and maybe sad for the losers, but there's always another 4 years that they can try. And a lot of people I know, that they may have tried on the local level as a city or a town councilman, they work their way up and try for another public office in the years ahead. So it's always an opportunity to get your foot in the door and try for a better public office, and maybe you'll succeed the next time around. Thanks for spending time with us to talk about today, though.
It's my pleasure. And actually, let me put a push in there for people to not be frustrated by losing an election. It you don't win the first one all the time. And congratulations to the people who decided to put their name in the hat, so to speak. And please don't, because you lost one, think that means you should never run again. It's a challenge, and you can maybe run for the same office, different office. We need people to run so that we have those good, vibrant, competitive elections.
And we've noticed some newcomers that have made some good strides if they made the second time or third time around, and they've actually gotten into public office and they've made some good for their communities. That's always important to remember, too. So, Andy, as always, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Andy Downs is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Our next guest here on Regionally Speaking is a fellow who is stepping down. He's retiring from his position as the CEO, president and CEO, actually, of Regional Health Systems. Bob Crunwy has been in the organization for 30 years. And it's nice to have him in the studio to talk about the time that he has spent here in Northwest Indiana with such an important organization as RHS. And thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
If you will, tell us about, first, I guess, maybe going all the way back, a little bit about your background, which you did a little bit earlier, but about how your background got you into this position in the first place.
Sure. A lot of it is just happenstance. I had every anticipation of getting into the school of medicine and becoming a physician, and then discovered I didn't like chemistry, which was an ugly fit. So I ended up going to the school of medicine anyway. They had a program then in hospital administration, and the idea was you could spend some time there and maybe go into the school of medicine or the school of dentistry. And remembering that I didn't like chemistry, I decided to stay in the school of hospital administration that IU had at that point in time. And I got placed in a hospital for my residency in Omaha, Nebraska. And the week before I was supposed to show up, I called to ask where I was supposed to show up. And they had fired the proctor that I was supposed to be working under. And so I had to find someplace really quick for another residency because I had 2 weeks to do it or I was going to have to sit out of school for another year. So I called the father of a friend of mine from Newcastle who happened to be the commissioner of mental health for the state of Indiana, Dr. William Murray. And he placed me out at LaRue Carter Hospital. Mm-hmm. And so everything just kind of snowballed after that. And, you know, it's one of those things where most wonderful set of catastrophic issues that ever hit my life. And I just never left. So from 1978 forward, I've been in the mental health field. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little about LaRue Carter Hospital. It's a unique place in its own. There are a number of hospitals around the state like LaRue Carter in the system. There's one, the LaRue Carter. There's one in Richmond. There are a number of other cities around the state that have, I guess, what the sad some people call mental health facilities, but some people call them insane asylums, which is the bad way to put it because that's not always the way. But we know that in history, that's the way they've been viewed.
Absolutely. And there's fewer now than there used to be. You know, when I worked for the Department of Mental Health, and I was down there for 4 years too, we had close to, I want to say 20,000 residents there. We now have under 700. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's and they're spread out among four. Let's see, there's Richmond, there's Evansville, there's Logansport, and then there's the one in Indianapolis, and that's the and Madison. So there's five facilities now, and there used to be seven, and there used to be five facilities for folks who are developmentally disabled, and they're all gone. So that's changed a lot over the years.
What did you find when you were able to come up here to Northwest Indiana, since you were down in Indianapolis, an area that you liked about what was up here, and how much of a good fit did it seem to be to get involved with, which is now the regional mental health services systems?
Well, at the time, it was a fit of necessity. I worked for the Department of Mental Health and spent some time actually as acting commissioner under the Robert Orr administration. And you might remember there was an election then, and the Republican was defeated, and Evan Bayh became the new governor. And I actually had gone to school with Evan, so I knew him. But it was clear that because I worked for a Republican, I needed to move on.
Right.
And so there were only two jobs available at the time, and I had a family, so I needed to find one. One of them was in Terre Haute, and the other one was up here. And I decided to come up here only because I could come in earlier, and it seemed like a better option for me. Frankly, the person that ran the facility before left under less than desirable purposes or circumstances. And one of the things I have learned throughout my career, it's always best to follow somebody that didn't do so well. You don't pale by comparison that mm-hmm. way. And it's worked out wonderful for me.
What did you find when you came in? First, let's ask, what was the organization that you came into at first, and what did you find when you stepped into that position?
I came into Tri-City Mental Health Center in mm-hmm. East Chicago, and its past executive director had some issues, ended up in the Federal Witness Protection Program, actually. But what I found was a staff that was really delightful and really wanted to do the right thing and really was depressed because of the pale that was cast over them by these other issues. And these folks worked so hard and were so committed to the folks that they were treating that it was exactly what we wanted when I worked for the Department of Mental Health. We wanted folks that were very individually oriented, bent on getting folks back into the community, and wanted to do the right thing. And they were all up there. It was really a unique program.
What did you finally get to do as some of your first expansion plans that kind of brought things along? And bring us up to date to where we are today, please.
Well, with everything in the world, you know, it's like a big clock. The hand just keeps turning, but it comes back to the fore every once in a while. And when I was there, substance abuse was a big ticket item in the state of Indiana. There was a large need for substance abuse facilities, primarily for alcoholism, but also for cocaine was a big drug of choice. There's always been heroin in the system, but that wasn't a big ticket item. And up at Tri-City, we then ended up opening up 45 beds to treat folks with chronic substance abuse issues. At that point in time, the state paid for the services, and we never had an empty bed. We usually had a waiting list of probably 3 to 4 weeks for somebody to get into one of those beds. And that was a great service, and it was one of three in the state of Indiana. One in Indianapolis and another in Evansville. And so we kind of focused on that. And at that point in time also, folks were realizing that folks with mental illness might be addicted too. And so we had a really big cross population of folks that had chronic and seriously persistent mental illness who were also addicted. And so we kind of carved that niche out for us ourselves too. And kind of rode that wave for a while. Also opened a lot of group homes. Those group homes were a new issue in the state of Indiana at that point in time, and it was extraordinarily difficult to find a community that would welcome a group home. I remember I was going to put a group home in East Chicago next to a bar that had a kind of a sully reputation. Its nickname was the Bucket of Blood. The priest shows up to remonstrate against me because he thought I was going to degrade the neighborhood. You know, the bar wasn't, but I was. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, we had a really great director of housing in East Chicago, John Artis, who's a super guy. And John saw this going on and found another spot for us in East Chicago, and we've just kind of built on that since then.
Bring us to where Geminis Corporation fits into the picture, and I know that's part of the expansion that's gone into where we are today.
Sure. What happened was Lee Strawn, who was the director at the Southlake at the time, and I would ride down to Indianapolis a lot because we both happened to be on the board of our trade association at that point in time. And we both started talking about how hard it was for us to take care of the administrative burden that we were feeling and how we had to find ways to cut our costs. And so on one of the trips, we decided, well, maybe we could combine all of our administrative duties into one job and share them between the two of us. So as a result, we opened up Geminis there in Pine Island in Merivale, and it was a relatively small shop, but it did all the back room activities for the two mental health centers, accounts receivable, IT services, HR services, all that good stuff, medical records. And so we developed that program. About 4 years into it, the Head Start program in Indiana went up for bid. They weren't happy with their current provider. We threw our hat in the ring, just feeling like, you know, that's something we could do. And we might be able to do it pretty well, and we really didn't expect to get the grant, and sure, so that meant we were going to get it, and we did get it, and we've started running the Head Start service too, and then we started doing lots of social services in the community, and Geminis has grown from a group of what I think was originally 20 employees up to about 300 now, doing everything that's just short of therapeutic services for the community, do a lot of work for DCS and folks like that.
What type of feedback have you gotten over the years from folks locally and even folks in Indianapolis about how things have gone up here and the expansion and how the services that was just now all part of the region has turned out?
Like most areas, actually better than most areas, we get very good feedback on what we do. You know, we have a dedicated staff. We now provide primary health care services too through HRSA, and that's important because the reality is folks with chronic mental illness die 20 years earlier than the rest of the population, but they don't die because of their mental illness. They die because of physical illnesses that have gone unattended because of their mental illness. You know, they can't run the gamut of where they need to go to get their physical health care taken care of. So our board of directors about 10 years ago took it upon themselves to see if we couldn't get into the primary care business, and we do that now. And we have clinics in each of our major mental health settings too. And so our clients don't have to leave the building to get their health care attended to. We go find them. And so it's really worked out great. You know, folks with diabetes is a big thing in the chronically mentally ill field. We can keep that under control. We also have dentists. So we give them the whole nine yards here. We are literally a whole person activity, and we have all the providers under roof.
Is there any area, since you've been able to encompass so much now into the regional health systems now, which is the name, including all of these things that are going beyond mental health and treatment and diagnosis, are there any other areas that you think that you can fit into now, as the organization can fit into maybe for the future? Are you pretty much happy with what you've got and you need to just kind of fine-tune it a bit?
Well, in general, it is a fine-tuning issue, but it's always been a fine-tuning issue. One of the things that we're really focusing on now is we're one of two centers in the state, and I think 20 nationwide, who got a grant for the Certified Community Mental Health Center system. It's a federal grant where you do everything for the client, and you get a flat fee to serve these folks. And so right now what we're in the process of doing is hiring more healthcare folks and training our behavioral healthcare folks to be able to do basic biometric measures while they're doing case management services with folks in their home. So we can stay on top of what's going on with their blood sugars. We can stay on top in terms of what's going on with their blood pressure, all in one visit. Because the reality is these mm-hmm. folks have an awful lot on their plate. And when we go to do a home visit, we get about 20 minutes of productive time out of a 40-minute visit. Because the first 10, they want to tell us how their week went. The second 10, they want to tell us what they're doing the next week. And so we got that 20-minute period there where we've got to get the information we need out of these folks. And in some cases, it's how come you're not taking your blood pressure medication? It's through the roof. Or other cases, you know, it's clear you're not taking your psychotropic medication by your rambling, just like I am right now, behavior here.
Only you're not on the medication, though.
That's right.
There's so much to cover in just a short period of time that we have together to talk, to be sure. Also, too, I can't let you go without talking a little bit about the honors that you picked up. And interestingly enough, you got picked up from your old boss, too.
That's right.
And I'm referring to the going all the way back to the Distinguished Hoosier Award that you received from then-Governor Robert Orr.
Yep. If you hang around long enough, they always give you a piece of paper. And that's what happened here. Governor Orr, we actually done a lot of work with what we call the assertive case management program in Indiana, where we took folks that were most fragile as it related to their mental health status, left them in the community, but we kind of put a big brother with them to watch them all the time. And it was a team, so that nobody ever got burnt out. And so in recognition of that and working with the same kind of system with kids, he gave me a Distinguished Hoosier Award. And then Evan By was kind enough when I left, I think it was just to get rid of me, made me a Sagamore of the Wabash. And that was impressive. I've got to admit, I'm not sure I ever really deserved that, but I still have it on my wall and I'm not taking it down.
I'm going to mention probably that he has referred to a number of people and having you on the list for that, the award in particular, said, well, what's this guy done? You know, he's done this, this, and this, and this, and he's taken this organization that started out just as a facility in East Chicago all the way up to where it is today over Northwest Indiana, and in turn has been able to make the improvements over the time that you've been in office before up to getting the award. And the award we're, of course, referring to is the Sagamore the Wabash Award, and not many people have it out
there.
They don't. And luckily, a lot of people that have it certainly do treasure the award, and I'm sure that you do.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the future now, and the fellow who that they have chosen, your board of directors have chosen to take over now that you're going to retire, and you get to break in somebody new. Well, he's not new. I should not say that's true. Bill Trowbridge has been around for a while, I understand.
He has, and most recently he's been running the Michiana Industries in LaPorte County and Paladin here in Lake County and also in LaPorte County, which is a service for folks that are developmentally disabled and or intellectually disabled. You used to call them MR folks, mentally retarded. Now it's DD, ID. Mm-hmm. And he's ran that service for, I think, the last 4 years, and he's crossing over into our service area. Delightful guy. Is an attorney by training. That's the only fault I find in them.
Well, I guess it's always the case. You know, sometimes the people that are meant to be in certain industries turn out to have education backgrounds that are certainly maybe completely different from what they did before, too.
So. Well, I have an attorney. My son's an attorney, so I don't.
So you can't.
I gotta watch what I say.
You can't badmouth the bar too much.
That,
I know.
But he's great. He'll do well.
Have you had a chance to work with him, or has he come in yet? I know he doesn't start really until next month.
We're staying in communication, so that you know he knows what's going on, and he'll start with the organization on the 16th of December, mm-hmm. and it'll be kind of up to he and I as to how long I hang around then to fill in the voids for him. I don't think it'll take long. He knows a little bit about this field, and he's a quick learner. And he certainly knows where the Department of Mental Health is because that's where he gets his funding too.
Well, Bob, thank you for spending time with us talking about history, about the importance of how the regional health systems started out as just a small organization and grown into the one that it is today and the one that is so encompassing in helping in many ways the mental as well as physical health of so many people here in Northwest Indiana. And we appreciate you taking time with us to talk about it.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
We've been talking today with Bob Crumweed, who is retiring and soon to step down as being the president and CEO of the Regional Health Systems here in Northwest Indiana. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. From time to time, we do have some opinion makers on, that is, people who have some comments to make. We've had folks from the Times on, and it's now time for the Post-Tribune. That is to say, we have Jerry Davich, who is a columnist for the Post-Tribune, to join us on the program today to talk about, I guess, actually a series of columns, isn't it? I think several of them, including one that came out on Wednesday, which I'll ask a little bit about, too. But they have centered lately here over the town of Ogden Dunes. And first off, Jerry, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Chris. I appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you for giving us the time to go through this here. I'll let you kind of explain things first. Give us a little primer about the town of Ogden Dunes. And in reference to what I first made here about the fact that you kind of expanded the series of columns to one on Wednesday as well, to get you to kind of throw in some comments, because that does fit into this as well, too. Give us just a brief primer, if you will, of the situation with the town of Ogden Dunes. And a lot of it has to do because they're right on the lake, isn't it?
Yeah, part of the problem is they're located on the lake just north of Portage, of course, in Porter County. It's a small lakefront town that has roughly 600 or so homes, I believe, and 1,200 or so residents. And I've been hearing from them off and on through the years about problems they've had with some town officials, one in particular, and I didn't do anything about it. And then the last month or two, I've heard more and more rumbling, so to speak, and then I heard from an outside contractor who's trying to help a couple homeowners get some walls put up, like shoreline protective walls, around their home and their property. And the plan commission is making them dot the I's, cross the T's kind of thing of getting things exactly done up to code. I heard complaints from the contractors and complaints from some residents, not a lot of residents, but some residents, and they're very vocal. And it circles around one gentleman named Mike Falk, and he is the plan commission chairman who's been in office, appointed by the town council, I think 3 years. He has another year or so to go. So after hearing all these rumblings, I finally did write this column that ran a few days ago. I think it was 4 or 5 days ago online and mm-hmm. Monday in print. And then I kept hearing more complaints and more back and forth. So I thought there was a bigger issue here, how the town of Ogden Dunes is kind of a microcosm for many other towns in Northwest Indiana and probably the country, on how there's a disconnect with public trust and public distrust between residents and public officials. So my point of my second column, which ran on Wednesday, was to simply say, let's use this problem they're having at Ogden Dunes, even though it's a community most readers, most listeners maybe not care about if you don't live there, but we can learn from it. We can learn from their mistakes, their disconnect. They're not talking. There's been curse words. There's people are secretly recording meetings. Public meetings are being held to one-minute comment portion. When a resident stands up, they cut you off at 1 minute. Just a lot of problems I've heard from a lot of different communities across Northwest Indiana, I'll bet, for the last 20 years. And I thought this was a perfect microcosm and a perfect opportunity to maybe take some lessons from it.
Now, you mentioned, I know, in the columns, I guess up to today's, it's online, it talks about, I guess, the problems that the residents have. And then you also mentioned, too, about the contractors that are trying to do business not only with residents, but also, I guess, with the town of Ogden Dunes, too, or at least be able to deal with them. Tell us from the standpoint of what the businesses, in this particular case, I guess, the contractors, have to say about all this.
Well, the first contractor that contacted me was a man named Tom Frame, and he's with Duneland Landscaping in Chesterton, and he was a former resident of Ogden Dunes for quite a while. Now I believe he lives in Chesterton, but he's no longer in the town. But he does work with the town, and he works with homeowners trying to rebuild some of their properties, their property walls, and he says an independent contractor has approved his plan, as well as a statewide commission, and the homeowner approves it, but the town is a little more strict. On the flip side, this plan commission chairman, Mike Fox, says that he's just enforcing the code, simple as that. He's not a bully, as he's being claimed to be. Mm-hmm. He's not being intimidating, as he's claimed to be. Mm-hmm. And he's just doing what his job, what he was appointed to do, is to make sure code enforcement gets enforced. So from a business perspective, they're saying that the town is not playing nice with them at all. They're being overly aggressive with trying to get everything in order, and they're keeping people away. And there's some contractors who've told me that they simply won't do business with the town of Ogden Dunes anymore because of this.
Uh-huh. You mentioned in particular, I guess, some of the issues that Mr. Frame run into. Tell us about some of the problems that he particularly seemed to have with the codes and what he tried to do, I guess, to kind of get around them, at least to comply as best as he could.
Yeah, he was told to do a certain wall this way, a certain wall that way. Mike Falk has told me in the last just two or three days or so that he even showed me some examples. And to be honest, Chris, it's way over my head, all the engineering design work that they're calling for. But from the flip side, it goes back and forth. And one will say that it is made up to spec and it passes the codes, and it got passed by an independent engineering firm. And the town says, no, it's not up to code yet, and this is wrong, and that is wrong, and this is wrong. It's been lingering now for 2 to 3 years, just this one homeowner, this one case, through Tom Frame, with the town. And the last thing Tom Frame told me is we'll have to share this with a judge at some point. So that's what most towns, communities in Northwest Indiana do not want to happen, but that's what's apparently going to happen in Ogden Dunes.
I know you mentioned in your column about having to go to some outside help, I guess, at least maybe some advocacy groups, I guess in Indianapolis in particular, might be able to help him out. Tell us what kind of help that the contractors, and maybe in this particular case is one contractor and maybe some others, might have to do if they have to deal with the situation in Ogden Dunes.
Yeah, well, Frame contacted the Indiana Builders Association downstate in Indianapolis just for some guidance and to prove that what he's doing for these codes is correct. He's going through the right channels. So I contacted the Indiana Builders Association for the exact kind of guidance, like what he should do. There's a quote I have from Carly Hopper, the organization's governmental affairs director, and says, I provided Mr. Frame with information pertaining to the state statute on timely issuance of building permits and commission approval. So the whole thing is down to timeliness and issuance of things. And the contractors say it's definitely not timely. It's 2 years plus running, of course, is not timely. So one of the groups has stepped up. Another resident, Bob Schwartz, filed a consumer complaint with the Indiana Attorney General's office. That was just done last week, I believe. And all the office, when I contacted them, they couldn't confirm they got the complaint. I actually saw the complaint, so I know they received it. Now, whether they act on it, investigate, I'm not sure. Another resident is asking for an ethics investigation into the town of Ogden Dunes and the town officials. So everything's still kind of in the works, and all this latest controversy really just took place the last week or two. It's all been lingering and simmering. Now it's kind of boiling over the pot.
Now, you mentioned in the latest column that says out in the newspaper and online as well, too, about your conversation with Mike Falk. Tell us what the chairman of the Plan Commission has more specifically to say about all this.
Well, when I contacted him initially, he gave me a statement, as I get often from town officials, and the statement simply said, the town council supports me. They're behind my work. We are doing everything we're supposed to be doing, and they just don't comply simply with the code.
Yeah.
And I expected that. But then I heard back from Mr. Falk after my initial column ran, and then he was a back and forth with me via email, actually on Sunday, right before the column was going to run. He says, help me understand why these people think I'm being harassing them or bullying or retaliation. So we're going back and forth with that. He says, my columns have only given the poor contractors, quote-unquote, a voice. And these poor contractors also promise to follow the code when applying to register in town, and then they don't. So his claim, he's staunch about this. He's not wavering, and he just simply says it's all black and white, and they're not following code. My point was that talking would help. Just sit down and sit at a table. My job as a columnist, I sit and talk with people a lot, and I figure that you could break some walls down, figuratively and literally, if you just sit down, open a forum, have a dialogue, talk, Don't raise your voice. Don't curse, of course. And maybe something can get done. But I don't think that's going to happen in Ockenden.
And you also mentioned, too, in that, I guess, the latest column, too, like some comments that a former resident, of Ogden Dunes, a former businessman in the region, Jim Slowinski, had to say he was actually a member of the plan commission in the town. Tell us how he kind of offered his view about all of this.
Yeah, he sent a letter to the town council after my first column ran, and it simply said, regardless of what is legally required or not, if the town council really cares about the community and our fellow residents' major concerns, you would not limit their opportunity to speak. And I thought that really hit it on the head, exactly the point of my second column. Just don't limit communication, of course. Even if you're, even if the town is correct and in behind of the staunch letter of the code, don't rule out these residents, these citizens who simply want to either voice their concerns or complaints or gripes that makes only things worse. And then they're going to contact people like me, which is the last thing they want. Then they accuse me, of course, like I'm part of this issue, and I'm not. I'm just writing about it. But I think if they could just sit down. What Jim Slowinski said is, as an engineer and a former member of the Plan Commission, he was part of the Plan Commission, I am well aware of this has been a long-standing issue, which was made worse when this particular individual, Mr. Falk, became chairman. While on the Plan Commission, I saw firsthand his my way or the highway erratic behavior, which brought us to this current situation.
Well, and you mentioned, too, that Mr. Falk has one more year to go, I guess, on his appointment from the town council. And obviously, the town council probably isn't going to make any changes to the appointments, apparently not in the near future anyway, I would imagine.
I'm not sure if they will. Of course, some of the residents are asking for Mr. Falk to step down. I don't believe he's going to step down. And the town council at this point is supporting him. So maybe this could linger in for another year. Maybe it can go to court. Maybe we should learn a lesson from.
One thing that you mentioned, and you do mention in the columns, too, is to make, and you did at the start of our conversation here, about the fact that, the town of Ogden Dunes is not unique. I guess it's maybe being a smaller community. You say it gets overlooked a lot of times until things like this seem to come to light. And you mentioned that it says it's kind of a microcosm, maybe is one way to put it, for a lot of other communities in Northwest Indiana.
I hear this a lot, Chris, from different communities. People just simply want a voice. They don't know where else to turn. Their town or their city officials or leaders are not really listening to them. The public comment portion of a meeting, let's say a public town council or city council meeting, they don't get their time or they feel they're not being listened to. So, yeah, this is definitely a microcosm. People can just sit down. I mean, it would be very interesting if these principal players for this Ogden Dunes situation could sit down into a room and a table across from each other, take some notes, talk with each other, and see if they can have a resolution. And I think every other community is having to just disconnect can do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jerry, thanks for sharing your information with us. And the columns, of course, are out there for all to see, either in newsprint or also online, if you like. And thanks for spending time to go over them with us today.
Yeah, they can find it on my Chicago Tribune webpage or my Facebook page. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you, Jerry. Jerry Davich is a columnist for the Post-Tribune. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and now here's Tom Maloney.
With this week, of course, being Veterans Day, it's only fitting that we welcome into the studio Mitch Barloga to discuss the Northwest Indiana Middle East Veterans Memorial, the memorial being built in Hebron. Mitch, welcome. And
thank you, Tom.
We first heard about this way back in the summer, I think in June, but you've got some updates now for us.
Yeah, we certainly do. And the town of Hebron has been quite proactive, including a gentleman by the name of Don Ensign. And Don Ensign is a councilman over there. And we've been working closely with him and with the rest of the town on getting a property for a memorial. And we've been doing that for quite some time working with them. They have a strip of land where the old Pennsylvania Railroad came through between U.S. 231 and an adjacent side street. And we were able to carve out about an acre and a half of property that we were been able to lease from the town of Hebron for the development of a memorial to the veterans of the Middle East. And when I say we, I'm talking about the Friends of the Veterans Memorial Parkway. And we're the group, we're a nonprofit organization that has been advocating for the development of the Veterans Memorial Parkway, which goes from St. John to Hebron. And we're having a lot of success of late working on memorials in Crown Point and now in Hebron.
The Middle East Veterans Memorial, that's going to be serve as a memorial for those who have died in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, as well as other tours of duty in the Middle East. 26 soldiers have lost their lives in the Middle East here in Northwest Indiana. Have you talked to any of the families, anybody who might be attending this that might have somebody who's going to be memorialized on that?
Well, certainly. We've spoken to a few Afghan and Iraq veterans. In fact, at one of our call-out meetings we had a few weeks ago, a gentleman who actually served in Beirut was present, and he asked right up front, is this a Gulf War memorial or is this a Middle East memorial? Because there's a difference, especially in his mind. And, you know, we said, no, we're trying to bring in all the Middle East. And he was very pleased to hear that because he was from Beirut, the Lebanon conflict. And he has people that he knows who have perished from Northwest Indiana who served in Beirut. So this goes back to the 80s and 90s. So this is pre-Saddam Hussein and Desert Storm time. And so we want to make sure we're very cognizant of working with all of these veterans. And we hope to, through the work of this memorial project, through the event that we have on Sunday, that we can bring more and more people to understand what we're doing and then work with them on the design, the eventual design and development of this this project.
The service is taking place on Sunday, November 17th at 2 o'clock at Park Place and Wilson Street over in Hebron. And you still don't have the design created. Is it still a work in progress?
Yes. What we want to do again, Tom, is by having these events and getting the word out, we want to bring more and more families of those who have loved ones who may have died in the Middle East, or those who have served, and veterans who had served in the Middle East, to come forward to help us with the design of this project. So right now it's going to be a flagpole and a sign and future site of, and from there we want to work with them and we want to be sensitive to what they would like to see on this with this eventual project. To us, it's important to tell a story with our Korean Memorial, which is just up the road and near this hamlet of Leroy. We have on the back side of the wall pretty much the entire history of the Korean War, including a map. So if you actually took the time to read this, you'd be like an amateur historian of the Korean War, because many people don't even understand about the Korean War at all. And still, there was 101 people that lost their lives from Lake County alone, and that it was a very bloody conflict. And the Middle East is of the same, you know, nature, where people may have heard of Afghanistan, Iraq, but there have been so many different types of conflicts. We want to make sure people are sensitive to what our soldiers have sacrificed for and what they have endured in their service over there. And we're very we're very careful about making sure people understand a history as they're experiencing these projects.
If people want to learn more, or if they want to be able to contribute to this, or they've got somebody that they've lost, how do they get in contact with you, or who do they get in contact with?
We have a couple of outlets online. There's the main website for the Parkway, which is vetparkway.com, all one word, vetparkway.com. And we have a Facebook presence, like many other organizations do, Friends of the Veterans Memorial Parkway. So we really encourage people who are interested in helping us out, maybe even telling us a story or two of their service or their family member service in this conflict, to please reach out to us. We're more than, we're very willing to talk to them, and we're eager to talk to them about, you know, what they can provide for this project going forward.
We're talking with Mitch Barloga, who is the board president of Friends of the Veterans Memorial Parkway, about the upcoming site dedication on Sunday, November 17th for the Northwest Indiana Middle East Veterans Memorial. And Mitch, the last time I spoke with you was following the announcement back in May about the Veterans Memorial Trail. That was part of the state's Next Level Trails program. I think there's 3 to 5 trails in Northwest Indiana that were getting some extensions.
Yes.
Or some build-throughs. What's the status there?
Well, and that's interesting, because this ceremony is also going to signify the groundbreaking of the first phase of the Veterans Trail from the very project we had spoke about in May. As I explained back then, Next Level Trails is state money. And because it's state money, things go a lot faster. And I usually work with trail development in this region with federal money, and there's a lot of hoops to jump through, a lot of regulations to deal with. But with state money, we're dealing with just pure, you know, unattached monies that are coming directly from Governor Holcomb. And because of this, we're able to expedite many of the different permitting processes. And because of this, the town of Hebron is really ready to begin construction of this project in early spring. And we would like to have, while we're doing the dedication of the Middle East Memorial, we'd also like to have a ceremony, too, of groundbreaking for this first phase, which is going to take place. It's going to be constructed from the county line all the way to near the center of Hebron as this first mile is constructed. And, of course, the Veterans Trail itself will go from Hebron to Crown Point when it's eventually constructed. And there are several different phases of it in the Crown Point vicinity that have been funded by the Lake County Parks. And we're looking forward to seeing those ground broken for and constructed within the next 2 to 3 years.
So there's a lot on your plate.
It's a big plate.
It's a big plate. You fit maybe a couple of more projects on there, Mitch. Thanks so much for swinging by our studios to discuss both of these events. Again, Sunday, November 17th, 2 o'clock at Park Place and Wilson Street in Hebron. If you want to go ahead and attend, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
That's Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. And our thanks to Mitch Barloga, who was talking about the upcoming site dedication for another Veterans Memorial here in Northwest Indiana. Also to Andy Downs from the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics. To visit here in the studio and the conversation with the Regional Health Systems retiring president and CEO Bob Crumweed, and to Jerry Davich from the Post Tribune for his contribution today as well. It's going to be a short week next week for Regionally Speaking because of the events in Washington that we're going to be bringing you from NPR News. We will be back with you on Monday.